The information provided is not intended to be a comprehensive review of all developments in the law and practice, or to cover all aspects of those referred to. Listeners should take legal advice before applying it to specific issues or transactions.
Hello, my name's Tim Morris. I'm a consultant in the debt capital markets practice at Ashurst in London. I'm joined today by Alex Biles, who's a partner in the debt capital markets practice, and Chris Hardingham, counsel in the debt capital markets practice. We're going to look quickly today at recent developments in the world of debt capital markets from a legal perspective. So Chris, if I can turn to you first, what's going on at the moment? What's really interesting?
Well, it's been a transformative month for the capital markets, January 2018. We've had a number of important regulations and directives come into effect, primarily MiFID II, which everyone will be aware of who works in this field. The PRIIPs regulation we've all been preparing for as well over the last few years, and also the benchmark regulation has come into effect as well, with consequences for processes and documentation alike. And on top of that, we've also had an interesting case, the judgment for which came out just before Christmas, which had some interesting points for capital markets practitioners, and it's something we'll be looking at later in the podcast.
So the first thing you mentioned was MiFID II, and I know this is a huge subject, but Alex, how does this particularly affect debt capital markets transactions?
So we've seen a significant change in internal processes amongst our clients, particularly banks acting as arrangers and managers on transactions. And what we hear is this has led to significant overhaul of internal processes behind the scenes of originating transactions. In purely documentation terms, there's been some updates to disclaimers and selling restrictions and what have you, which have been led by ICMA. So on the documentation side, there hasn't been, to be honest, a huge change, but we understand that this is really causing a big headache for internal compliance teams and groups within banks. It'll be interesting to see exactly where product governance regime comes out in terms of the effect for distributing securities, and whether there'll be a significant impact overall on transactions, whether we really will see a change in the way or the types of investors who hold these securities. From what we're seeing so far, there's been some changes around the edges of transactions. I think we're seeing fewer wrinkles to distributions. So typically, you know, over the years, we've often seen last minute requests to place securities with private banks in certain jurisdictions, or, you know, last minute requests for directors to participate in offerings. And we're seeing fewer of those types of requests. But overall, I think the jury's out to see whether the product governance regime overall will change significantly the nature of distribution, and actually whether it just generates a whole load of additional work for banks as part of their origination policies.
I must say it seems to me that way as well, and I think one of the crucial things will be over the next few months we see how the product governance regime beds down, and in particular how national competent authorities interpret these new provisions. Okay, so let's move on to the next subject that you mentioned, and that is the PRIIPs regulation. Again, there's been a lot of work put into preparing for the PRIIPs regulation coming into effect at the beginning of this year. How's it actually turned out in practice, Alex?
Interesting question. I think there's, in some ways, a split in the market. There's definitely those deals where the market participants are very happy to simply carve out retail investors, and by and large I think the PRIIPs regulation hasn't really had a significant impact on the way that those deals are originated. Where we're seeing a greater level of impact is obviously for the retail bond market, but also those corporate issuers who have either historic or going forwards, you know, occasionally tapped into what we classify as kind of retail investors under the PRIIPs regulation. For the pure kind of retail bond market, we're already seeing some ways in which it's both affecting liquidity and also new deals. A number of people we're talking to at the moment on new transactions are deliberately trying to structure the deal so that the securities are out of scope. So I think the PRIIPs regulation is already having an impact in that regard. So things like the removal of make whole, so that actually it's just a fixed redemption amount. And also for liability management transactions, particularly where you've got an out-of-scope instrument, I think the PRIIPs regulation does actually limit the options available to an issuer for restructuring its existing liabilities. And I think those issuers who do have out-of-scope instruments are very wary of not making it an in-scope instrument as a result of a liability management exercise. So for the retail bond market, there are already one or two impacts in the way that deals are taking shape. There are a couple of interesting points actually on liquidity as well. Obviously, the PRIIPs regulation is part of your efforts to protect consumer investors, but equally, we have heard stories of it having an impact on liquidity. We've had one or two clients ring up and say that investors have got in contact with them to say that legacy instruments which were issued before January 2018, which are in-scope products, individual investors, IFAs or brokers are refusing to sell them those products unless a kit is available. And I think a lot of those issuers would be surprised to understand that they have to go and prepare a kit for a deal which they originated a few years ago. So that's having an impact on liquidity already. And we're also hearing that corporate bond issuers have a real struggle to access the expertise required to prepare a KID, in particular the summary risk indicator and the performance and cost scenarios. I think there's a real dearth of expertise in that part of the market to, put bluntly, assist corporate bond issuers who have previously targeted that part of the market or would like to do so going forward. So the PRIIPs regulation is giving some real challenges already, I think.
And I think part of the purpose of the PRIIPs regulation was to protect retail investors and provide them with information that was easy for them to digest and enable them to compare products, so to assist the retail market. Do you think it's having that effect, or is it having a different effect on the retail market?
I think at the moment, to be honest, it's probably too early to make a true comparison. I think the way the market will go actually is more deals structured so that they're out of scope and therefore no KID has been prepared, and those deals which are squarely within the regime because, for example, they're in an RPI linked bond or something like that, which sit very squarely within the PRIIPs regulation. So you'll end up with a world where you've got some retail products for which there is no KID, and then those products where there is a document. And overall, will it enable easy comparison of the two deals? Personally, I'm sceptical, and it remains to be seen as to whether it is a true enhancement of the market. And I think there'll be more and more deals structured deliberately to fall outside the regime. And I think you'll see the retail bond market develop in a different way than, for example, structured products or indeed funds where the kids are produced as a matter of course and as part of that market and those businesses.
So I think in the structured products world, as Alex says, it remains to be seen the real impact, but there's every reason to be confident that actually it will help retail investors in that space in their comparison of different products and the risk analysis of those products. But one consequence we are seeing, of course, is the exclusion of certain products to the retail market. And this comes out really as a result of the ambiguity of some of the text of the regulation. And the market is taking a little bit of time to grapple with that and to reach a common ground on a lot of those points. We've seen that AFME has written a letter to the Commission to request clarity on some of these products. And by way of ambiguity, I'm talking about those very lightly structured features of corporate bonds, such as a make-whole linked to a government bond, which may inadvertently bring them within the scope of the regulation. The automatic response for issuers in that situation where there is some doubt is to request that the selling restrictions are imposed on the product, and that has had an effect on the liquidity in the retail market for those products. So hopefully we'll have some clarity from the Commission going forward, and those products which we expect to be outside of scope we'll all be confident that that is indeed the case, and it won't be so much of a risk for the issuer to take on in going ahead and without the selling restrictions.
I think that's an important point, because I think there is a slight inclination with a new regime coming into effect that the default position is you just put the selling restrictions in, you say they're applicable, and by doing that you're actually carving out distribution to the retail market entirely, whereas actually if if issuers and managers and their lawyers analyse up front whether actually the instrument is in scope or out of scope, and all being well, there's further guidance and the market settles down with its thoughts on those areas. The position should be that you don't need to impose the selling restrictions full stop, so therefore you do free up distribution to the retail market without having to produce a kit because everyone's comfortable that it's an out of scope product.
Okay, so watch this space. Moving on then to the benchmark regulation, which you mentioned, Chris, perhaps I can come back to you again. Is this having any significant impact at the moment in the debt capital market?
In the DCM space, the documentation impact has so far been reasonably limited. ICMA has helpfully put together some wording which most issuers seem happy to adopt, and that is taking off, and most issuers are including wording along those lines in their prospectuses. The other consequence, of course, which applies only to supervised entities, is the requirement to put the robust written plans in place under Article 28. And we've seen a mixed response to that in the market in terms of how easy it is to put those plans in place and how to go about doing so. I know that ISDA is working towards putting out a benchmark supplement, which I think a lot of issuers are waiting to see in order to assess how to put those robust plans in place. And until that time, I think we are in a little period of transition, and it will take a little bit of time to work out the best way to tackle those particular requirements.
On documentation, we're not seeing a huge amount of changes to the actual way in which the terms and conditions need to change going forward, so I think at the moment it's a bit of a holding period. Mm-hmm. For the plain vanilla corporate bond market, generally the sentiment is that FRNs have a relatively short maturity given market conditions at the moment, so it's not all that common that you're looking at a corporate bond issuer looking to issue a FRN beyond 2021. For the structured finance market and for the infrastructure debt market, typically they are big users of the IBORs, then obviously the consequences for new deals at the moment is far more significant. Compared to the loan markets, where ultimately there is a fallback to cost of funds of the lenders, so I think there is a bit of a fear that we're sitting on a time bomb, which will eventually, everyone knows it's coming, need to be dealt with over the next few years, and whether that's through a series of liability management exercises or whether there is a more like an ISDA protocol which the market looks to adopt, it remains to be seen. So at the moment, not many changes on documents and T's and C's, but I think everyone expects that this is something coming over the next couple of years. The other point we are seeing, particularly for financial institutions, is in risk factors. Chris has mentioned, obviously, the benchmark regulation risk factor, which we've seen in documents for a while now. There is a second level of disclosure which financial institutions need to be aware of, which is relating to large portfolios of their assets on their balance sheet, which are IBOR-based, and whether they need to consider a risk factor around repapering exercises or uncertainty as to what financial returns those products will generate going forward. So, personal unsecured loans or mortgage books, which ultimately have, for example, a LIBOR rate in them. So that's a change we're also seeing increasingly for financial institutions.
Yes, it seems to me that everyone's aware of the problem, that so many of these familiar benchmarks are likely to disappear in the coming years. But at the moment, nobody's really got a solution as to what to do. And I know there are a number of officially sponsored working groups looking at potential solutions, but as yet nothing concrete. And while in some markets, like the derivatives market or the loan market, it may ultimately be possible to introduce these solutions by way of bilateral or multilateral agreements, in the bond market, it's going to be a much more complicated process, and it's not clear to see at the moment quite how it's going to be achieved to deal with the vast number of outstanding legacy instruments where changes may need to be made to adhere to whatever the new solution is.
Indeed, I think liability management desks will be watching this space eagerly over the next year or two.
Chris, you also mentioned at the start that there's been an important new judgment. Would you like to tell us a little bit about that?
That's right. The Golden Belt case, as it's become known, it's a groundbreaking case in many respects, primarily because it's the first time under English law that a duty of care has been established between an arranging bank and the investors, and not just the primary investors, but also investors in the secondary market. And whilst the case concerned an Islamic financing transaction, it really has consequences for any type of securities transaction or any financing transaction where a bank holds itself out towards investors or other banks in a syndicate as performing certain functions. And we'll be looking at that in a bit more detail in a separate podcast.
Yes, that's right, Chris. It's really interesting to speculate quite how wide this duty of care may be what practical steps banks might be able to take to mitigate this duty in future. And it's quite a large subject, so we'll be looking at this in more detail in a podcast very shortly. That's all we have time for at the moment. Thank you very much for listening. If you're interested in finding out more about any of the topics we've discussed in this podcast, then there's a lot more information in detail available on the Ashurst website at ashurst.com.
The information provided is not intended to be a comprehensive review of all developments in the law and practice, or to cover all aspects of those referred to. Listeners should take legal advice before applying it to specific issues or transactions.